Hello and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And Jordan, you were on a beach for the last couple of weeks, which is why you didn't join us for the last few episodes. How was your vacation?
Oh, it was so good. I'm not even happy to be back, really. I was on the beach. I went to Grand Cayman and just literally was like a beach whale. I just ate and laid on the beach. And
would you say
ideal.
This is the one part of coming back that you were looking forward to?
Yeah. It was the one part that I felt like the worst, because I like kind of got all my ducks in a row for everything else with work before I left. And then I like landed at the beach and was like, man, I really didn't even talk to Anthony about the fact that I missed like three podcasts in a row. So, whoops.
No, you're
sorry,
here.
Man.
You're here. That's the important thing. Well, we're also joined by Brian Heater, who is not only here to help us talk about the new Netflix movie Roma, but he's also testing out a Rode mixing board. And so if you hear weird sound effects or in other ways don't enjoy this episode, you'll know it's his fault. How's it going, Brian?
I'm doing well.
I already hate it. We're off to a good start. It only took us about half an hour to get up and going with mics and situation. So.
This is terrible. I should say, as far as we know, it's not necessarily the Rode board's fault that we were having technical issues. That was more getting everything up and running again after you were gone, I think. Okay.
I just don't see why that would be like, whatever. I mean, we can argue about it later.
Literally,
but
nobody.
I don't have any understanding of how my computer just stops being functional.
I guarantee you that 0% of the audience wants to hear about your Skype problems. Like, if you've ever listened to a podcast before, that's what probably 50% of the conversations are.
That's what makes it so special, these podcasts, is that we talk about real life, you know?
I was telling you guys before we started recording that I recently did an interview with Tony Hawk for the site, and I had Skype problems with Tony Hawk, which is really, it hurt my heart. I was watching him on video and was unable to talk to him for a while.
Wait, so just to be clear, you said no one wants to hear about the Skype problems, and then you started telling us your Skype story.
But there was a famous person involved.
Okay. All right, so it has been kind of a light week as far as news goes, or actually not for tech news, but for some reason for streaming news.
It's been pretty, it died off at about Wednesday.
Yeah, it sort of trailed off.
Everybody is pretty much out for break at this point.
God bless us, everyone.
But one thing that did come out is Netflix, basically they posted a listing for something called Black Mirror Bandersnatch, which had the most interesting thing about the description was that the running time was 5 hours and 12 minutes. And so people are trying to figure out what this is. It's
like a Harry Potter movie.
Yeah. I think probably most likely we know that they're working on a Choose Your Own Adventure episode. So that seems like probably what it is.
Yeah. Because how long is a regular Black Mirror episode? Like an hour?
Yeah, roughly an hour, sometimes a little less. Brian is making shrugging motions because he's never seen any Black Mirror, I think. Is that
math
right?
That I can't do to figure out like how many paths there could possibly be to turn 1 hour into 5, 12.
Well, I think other question is like, if it's a Black Mirror episode and it's Choose Your Own Adventure, is there going to be a good ending that you can find, or is it just all going to be bad endings? Because I think like, If it has a happy ending, it seems like it's not really true to the spirit of Black Mirror. I mean, I know there have been one or two happy episodes, but in general, it's not something that tends to go well for the people involved.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's like a bleak way to, I guess most of them end pretty badly. But like, you know, there has to be like at least one happy ending, right? Like, also the thing about Black Mirror that it makes it such a good show, yeah, like it has like sci-fi and like this kind of like futuristic vibe to it and all that stuff, which seeing how these things play out both on like individual scale and on grand scales is really interesting. But at the end of the day, if you stripped all that away, it really is a story of decision making. Like the individual character from whose perspective you watch the whole show tends to make what, like 4 to 8 different decisions over the course of the show. And normally those decisions put them in an even worse position. Like that is the name of the game. So
they make
if there's
the wrong
a way
decisions.
To make Right. Yeah. It's like a handful of wrong decisions in a row, and the circumstances plus those decisions equals bad news. But there could, you know, you'd think, well, what if, you know, so-and-so character in that episode of Black Mirror had chosen to just tell the truth about this, or to come forward, or to, you know, tell someone else, or I don't know, like just made a different, not to do that or to do that. Right. Like maybe things would have ended differently for them. So I don't know. It's interesting.
With Showtime did a series like this, Mosaic. Oh,
yeah. No, that was wasn't it?
Showtime.
HBO? Oh,
it was.
It was a Soderbergh.
Oh no, you're right. It is HBO. Yeah, it's Steven Soderbergh, Sharon Stone. But so they did something.
Just to be clear, what just happened is you looked it up on the internet, and then I got it right, even though I wasn't looking it up. I just wanted to point.
And
that
then
out.
I went back and re-edited the Wikipedia page so that you were correct.
Okay.
I'm not looking at anything on the internet. My screen's black right now. Just FYI.
Congratulations.
This is all coming from up here.
You're still you're still mentally on Grand Cayman, aren't you?
Yes, 100%. It's raining outside, but yes.
They did, I don't know the specifics about it, but they did something similar where there was sort of a iOS Android app version of this, right? Where there was a kind of a fairly linear narrative on the show, and then you could sort of do kind of stitch it together on the app.
Right. Essentially, you could go on the app and you'd have an interactive experience, or you could just watch it like a regular TV show on TV. I think from what I saw about the ratings, no one bothered to watch it like a regular TV show.
I mean, it apparently wasn't very good, which obviously is something that Black Mirror has going for it, is that there's already a fan base. But what have they discussed what the execution of something like this would actually look like?
No. I mean, people only know, have like these very vague ideas. It'll be choose your own adventure. I mean, the Netflix actually has done some other, they've got a Minecraft story mode on Netflix right now, which I haven't played. So I can't.
You're such a big Minecraft fan.
So I think there's probably some precedent for, but I would imagine it would be very simple working paths, not like, because I think sometimes people have brought up the Telltale games as a precedent, but I think those do actually have some. Even though, I mean, they're not super sophisticated.
Has to exist within the broader infrastructure of Netflix, right? Both the browser and the mobile version. Mm-hmm. Although they're testing that instant replay thing. I wonder if that might have something to do with this.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, So I mean, right now it's really just a big question mark. If I were to guess, I would guess that it's just going to be, you know, choose one of two things. You have 10 seconds to choose, or we'll just choose one for you. And that there'll probably be something like, you know, 5 or 6 different endings, and one of them will be good. One of them will be moderately not terrible, and then a bunch of them will be pretty bleak.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the execution of this would be a lot more difficult than the video game, because you've actually have to have the actors act out all the different scenarios.
Right. So they've presumably shot. I mean, again, we don't know that this is the choose your own adventure thing. All we know is they posted something called Bandersnatch that was supposed to be 5 hours and 12 minutes, but choose your own adventure seems like the most likely explanation, unless they were like posting all the episode files, like,
or it was like an Andy Warhol style Black Mirror of just somebody
even
sleeping.
Even if they did that, it should be closer to like 8 hours or like 9 hours. If they did the whole season, like, they, why would they release a 5-hour season? That's just, I don't know. And to be clear, they said that they were going to do a choose your own adventure episode.
Yeah,
we're not just like making that up based on 5 hours, 12 minutes.
Right.
They said they were going to do something like this. And then there's all this weird, you know, someone said that they were filming a scene set in the UK circa 1984. And then that there was a ZX Spectrum game called Bandersnatch that never came out. It was said it was going to be a mega game, but then the studio went bankrupt or whatever.
Do we know what Bandersnatch
is?
God.
No.
Okay. Having watched Black Mirror.
It sounds like something with
James Vanderbeek.
No, it's Bandersnatch. No,
it
Bander,
like
not Bandersnatch.
A word for thievery.
Well, and the other thing is
Bandersnatch is a fictional creature in Lewis Carroll's 1872 novel Through the Looking Glass. Oh, I didn't know that.
Like
it
like
appeared
a,
in various adaptations of Carroll's work. They have also been used in authors' works and other forms of media.
So it's like a Jabberwocky.
It looks like a bird.
Yeah, like I'm seeing a picture of a bird wearing a fedora. It's a it's an MRA bird.
I mean, the other thing that
it's a bird,
mentioning
it's a bird that hates the new Ghostbusters.
Is that Charlie Brooker, who's the creator of Black Mirror, he was a games journalist before he became the creator of Black Mirror. So I think he probably knows, like, yeah, all this sort of weird gaming trivia, and maybe is itching to make a game himself. So we'll see how it turns out. I mean, I guess it also means the fact that they accidentally posted this suggested that it exists. It's not like this thing that they want to make years in the future, but this is a thing that they've probably shot a lot of footage for and is hopefully going to be on Netflix for real soon.
It'll be interesting if they're able to do it within.
Didn't the thing say December 28th? Like, it could be here really soon. Yeah, December
28th. There we go. Rather than real transitions, we can just have sound effects. It just goes on. The laugh track just goes on forever. Well, okay, I'm gonna talk over the laugh track. We don't have any other news that I think we were able to find. One other thing that I could mention is that opening this weekend, as we record this, are Aquaman and Bumblebee, and I've had a chance to see both of them, and I enjoyed both of them. I would say that I was surprised because I actually liked Aquaman more, which I think just in terms of like the buzz before the movie came out, people seemed more, I mean, I don't think either of them that many people were super excited about, but it seemed like there was a little bit more among like film critics, more buzz about Bumblebee. I think they're both good, but I had a really, really, really good time at Aquaman. If you, I think by the time this episode goes up, you'll be able to, I'll link to reviews I've written about both of them.
I respect what the director, was it James Wan?
James Wan.
James Wan of Aquaman said when they asked him, you know, why he ended up on that project, was he was just like, I want the superhero with the lowest bar. Like I want the one that people have the absolute least expectations about. And if you like, it's Aquaman is, I mean, obviously Aquaman is kind of infamous as being sort of like a laughing stock for, you know, superhero fans. He's like, he's got his domain in the ocean and can't really leave. His main thing is that he can talk to fishes. But also, if you ever watched the series Entourage, you know that that was also the James Cameron Aquaman movie was also a long plot line to that.
It's sort of like a joke. Like, yeah. As like the, I mean, I haven't
There's
seen
a running joke in the Big Bang Theory as well that, like, really? The guys always dress up as Justice League for Halloween, and nobody ever wants to be Aquaman. It always ends up being like Raj and then an outrageous Aquaman outfit. And they always make fun of them throughout the comic book scene. So,
well, I mean, already
that's as much as I know.
Aquaman is already like one of the biggest movies of the year in China, for reasons that aren't.
That is fascinating, Anthony. You know, I've talked about this a little bit, but there is this kind of understanding now in Hollywood that, especially with blockbusters, all the money gets made in China anyway. That, you know, like a movie could totally tank here and then it'll make all of its money back in China. So this is interesting to see them lead in China, which is not obviously super common with these sorts of movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that they still make a lot of money domestic. I think that they get the biggest cut still from domestic distribution. So they want a movie to do really well in the U.S. and it's tough for them to commit to a franchise if it's not doing well in the United States. But China is, you know, I think right now the number two market, and I think a lot of predictions are that within a few years it'll be the number one market for movies. And then there's certain kinds of movies that have, in fact, as you said, bombed in the U.S. And then the reason they weren't total disasters is because they continue to do well in China. So I mean, I think Tom Cruise's career outside of Mission Impossible at this point mostly exists because his movies still do well in China. And I think internationally in general, I think it's this weird thing where he's become an international, he remains an international star, but his like star has kind of faded in the U.S. Again, outside of Mission Impossible, where he's still amazing.
It'll be interesting to see if this actually impacts the way blockbusters are made. Remember that movie, it was like a year or two ago, came out with Matt Damon, the Great Wall movie.
Yes.
And it was primarily financed by the Laiko people.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it'll be interesting if they realize that like a certain portion of their money is made in China, whether that impacts their decision makings about which films get made.
It seems likely, and certainly that I think a movie that like you're spending like Aquaman levels of money, like hundreds of millions of dollars, you probably
will be forever known as Aquaman levels.
I mean, they spent a lot of money in this movie and it shows. I think you're not going to be able to make it unless you think it's going to be a global hit. Whereas like something like Get Out, which I think did well in the, like insanely well in the U.S., way better than anyone expected, didn't really do that well internationally, I think. But that's like a small horror movie, and so you can get away with
it. It's beyond that, though. It's also nuanced, and there are also, I suspect, a lot of aspects to that, you know, in terms of the storyline that wouldn't necessarily translate.
I think there are a bunch of explanations about why certain kinds of movies do well overseas and others don't. But I'm also just addressing the fact that I think you can have a movie that's made for $20 million, like Get Out. I don't remember the exact budget, but it's somewhere in that neighborhood. And if it only does well in the U.S., that's fine. A lot of comedies mostly do well in the U.S. That's fine. But if you want to do a big special effects spectacular, then you're probably gambling that it's going to do well everywhere, especially U.S. and China.
I mean, I think it goes both ways. Like, if you look at any Asian movie, the majority of them that have done well in the U.S., it's a lot of the sort of, you know, the martial arts movies, right? It's like a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's a movie that you don't need nuance and that you don't necessarily need, like, you know, to even know what people are saying. So it makes sense that those do well in countries where, you know, English is not the number one language.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, it makes sense. Wait, Brian and Jordan, are you going to go see Aquaman?
No.
No, I'm not going to either. I mean, I thought that was a given, but...
I assumed so, yeah.
Yeah, I probably won't see that.
I think
I'm gonna go see Spider-Verse next week.
I'm probably gonna go see Spider-Verse also.
Ben is back with Julia Roberts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm kind of curious about that one too.
I saw Creed the other night. That was quite good.
That's the kind of stuff I want to see.
Well, I will just say that if you want to just see like a crazy CGI adventure that happens underwater,
see Get Out.
See, Get Out.
The sunken place is quite literally underwater.
And then you see, Aquaman.
What if Aquaman 2 is Aquaman 2, the sunken place?
Probably not.
No,
probably not. Bumblebee is not a great movie, but it is probably the only good Transformers movie. So if that is your bag, go see it. But let's talk about a movie that I don't want to get ahead of myself. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but it's probably, I think, a genuinely great movie, which is Roma. Again, it's on Netflix. It is in a handful of theaters in major cities.
When we were talking about this, Anthony, you thought you were possibly going to go see it in the theater.
I wanted to see it in a theater, but I think the timing just didn't work out, so I ended up watching it at home. I will say that a lot of the stuff I end up watching for this podcast, I'll watch it on my laptop or my iPad, and this one I definitely made a point of watching it, you know, on the decent sized TV we have in our apartment, just like, so it was still a more immersive experience than watching it on my laptop, but it wasn't, I would like to see it in a theater at some point.
I watched it on the laptop, but on the 15 inch, not the 13 inch.
Okay.
So I feel so like I got the full experience.
You just were completely in that world. And
I watched it on my big living room TV.
Yeah. See,
I guess we're just sharing.
How was the experience, Jordan?
So it was interesting because when it first started, I got a kick out of like even the intro credits just felt like, man, I'm watching a movie from the 70s, right? Like I had read a little bit about it before I started it. And like most of what I read said this is more a story about a time and place than anything else. And like you get that feeling right from the beginning. And then as it started and kind of, you know, got off to its slowish start, I realized this was really a movie about like, or not about, but a movie for kind of film geeks in a way. Like it's obviously very technically beautiful and interesting, and like some of these large or like slow panning shots and all the movement behind them, like all of that is really beautiful. But I thought maybe I wouldn't get into the story, and just as it built, I like found myself like, the beginning of the movie, I was playing Bejeweled Blitz, and by the end, I was like hanging off every word. So it was like it was literally a very steady build to me, really like getting into and enjoying kind of the nuance of this movie. That's what
It feels like the story is like at the beginning, or the there's really no plot at the beginning of the story. It's just kind of like here's what her life is. And you get to just see a lot of the details.
It's potentially no plot throughout.
Yeah.
If you, like, honestly. You know what I mean? Like, there's things that happen, sure, but, like, there's no, like, end or meaning of anything, really. It is as it began.
Not in a traditional sense.
You know what I mean?
Right. There's a certain kind of like, let's just capture everything rather than like sort of have a traditional story shape.
Sure. It's atmospheric.
Right.
I went into it making sure I didn't read anything about it, and I was concerned for about the first, I would say, 48 minutes that it would just sort of be a very beautiful movie, but that, you know, that all of the positive reception it was getting was just based on it being very beautiful and cinematic. But it was, I mean, it's very much a portrait of the time, as you said, but also I think it does an amazing job juxtaposing class in a really interesting way. The thing is rife with symbolism too, and a lot of stuff that I'm going to want to go back and rewatch. I mean, the one probably most on the nose thing that you see in the movie are the airplanes, which bookend the movie. Yeah. And there's one right in the middle.
Oh, I didn't notice the one in the middle.
There's one in the middle when the guru is raising his hands up and an airplane flies between his arms.
Okay.
But, you know, like, especially in the 1970s and, you know, in Mexico at the time.
Relatively new.
Very much a status symbol, right? I mean, you know, a woman of her means is probably not someone who's going to be able to go and buy an airline ticket.
Right. There's a sense that she's very much in this very specific situation and you know, I keep wanting to say the word trapped, which is, I don't think, quite right, but that she doesn't have a lot of options.
There's not upward mobility.
Right. And so we should say...
Like, this is almost like her cap, right? Like, where she is right now is about as good as it gets, at least for the foreseeable.
But it's something that's, you know, very much shoved in her face a lot because she's working for this very wealthy family.
Right.
I just felt like I don't feel like she ever felt like used by them, or like that she was like, even like, she was clearly like not in the same socioeconomic class as them, and she did work for them, but she also got love and a family from them in a lot of ways. And like, her access to things, like the level of trust that she had as kind of the person running that household, was staggering, because she was the housekeeper or whatever her kind of role was. She was almost like a fly on the wall. So you watch the movie from her perspective and she's standing right there and they're arguing right in front of her, but they don't care that she's there, and she gets all of the access into everything that's happening in that household. I don't know. It just felt like a level of trust, not like she was being ignored, but like, I don't know. It was interesting. Like, it didn't feel like a bad thing.
I think her most interesting, the most interesting relationship in the film is between her and the mother.
Yeah.
If you look at her relationship and the children, like, very much just like fully like unencumbered love. Like, she was the person raising them. Like, she was probably more of a parental figure than either of the parents. You know, the father was just kind of a piece of shit, like, was just in and out. And
right.
who
once in a while would try to do, like, yeah. He clearly felt guilty and would try to do something good, but then he couldn't even do that much of it.
I mean, he was very much just like bird dogging around. Like, you know, the mother made up a lie that he was, you know, in was it Montreal, Quebec the entire time, I think?
Yeah.
Quebec or Ottawa.
Yeah. Some
various places in Canada.
Some French Canadian place in Canada. The mother, though, I think was interesting because, you know, she was on the surface very affectionate to this woman, but like every once in a while the kind of veneer would come off and then she would just like be really real about things in a way that was very upsetting, you know, both in terms of like the way she viewed her within the context of the family and also just like the relationships between men and women.
I thought that she...
I don't know. I think it's interesting to call it a veneer because like it felt like, even in the moments where she wasn't affectionate and maybe was a little bit more hostile towards her, like the love between those two women, I felt like was more profound and real.
I mean, I think there's
than any other love. You know what I mean? Like, they were partners more so than she was ever partners with her husband, more so than the main character. I forget her name in the movie and her name in real life. Cleo, yeah, was with the kids either. It was like they were the ones doing this together and trying to make sure these kids are happy and that the house keeps running. You know, I don't know.
I feel like my sense of the mother definitely evolved as the movie went on, because I think initially I definitely had more of a negative impression of her, because one of the first things that happens, right, is you see the father yells at the mother about how messy the house is, and then she immediately turns and yells at Cleo about not cleaning up the
Which happened shit. Several times in
yeah.
the film.
Well, I mean, but specifically the thing of the husband.
Sure.
You know, and I think that, yeah, to me it was less like like her showing her true self, or like a veneer being taken away, and more that you know, because that there was this power dynamic, and so it was about that she could, that this was the one way she could sort of like vent this frustration and anger that she has, that was the one person, you know, beneath her who she could sort of, that everyone was sort of punching down, right? And I think that was like, it didn't make me like her, but it was like understandable. It wasn't like that I think. Well, I was going to say that I think like that it was like both that she, especially that I think the mother saw Cleo as part of the family, and there's, without again going into the details of the ending, there's definitely like sort of an expression of love, and I think that genuinely the mother loves Cleo, and and the other family members love Cleo, but I think she's also, that Cleo is also an employee, and I think both of those things, and I think part of what is interesting about the movie is allowing those two, showing how those two things mix, and how, you know, they care for each other, and they care for her in a lot of ways, but that at the same time there is a difference in that, like, and I think, I mean, that's part of what, and again, maybe when we talk about the ending, I think there's, you know, the way that the movie ends, I think, is very intentional in sort of reinforcing that Cleo is, I mean, that they love her and she's their maid. I mean, and that both of those things are
they can coexist.
I think it's interesting because, like, maybe I'm reading into it too much, but it almost felt like Cleo, part of the reason that the mom loved Cleo so much was not only because she was there and caring for her children and, you know, doing so much for their family, but also because in some ways she was kind of aspirational. Like, the mom loses her shit a lot and takes it out on other people a lot. And like, Cleo just receives, and she's always like kind of calm and level-headed. Like, even her quote unquote outbursts, or even when she says something that might be inappropriate or uncomfortable, it was always in this way that was so vulnerable and authentic. And she never really, like, you know, the mom had moments where she was yelling at the kids because of something that happened with the dad, or yelling at her mom because of something that happened with the dad, or yelling at Cleo. And Cleo, maybe that was because she was an employee, but I think there was a lot of respect for Cleo to be able to kind of always kind of absorb all of these things without taking it out on anyone else. It would have been really easy for Cleo to kind of like continue on in the chain of yelling or frustration or anger. You know what I mean? But she didn't.
I mean, she had to be, though, right? I mean, she, you know, to a certain degree, she had to be obedient if she wanted to sort of continue in that role.
Right. You get the sense that it's a little bit that she can't, like, she certainly cannot yell back at the moment.
I mean, clearly she's like has the temperament and like was a good person in that position, but if she had snapped.
Right. That she couldn't, that, I mean, the only person she could probably yell at the kids in very selected and limited circumstances.
Well, I think her yelling at the mom would be able to get away with that easier if she yelled at the mom in private than if she had yelled at the kids.
I don't know.
Took out frustration on the kids.
I mean, maybe it was because there was another
fact that she kept the mom. Go ahead, you do it.
Sorry, there's a little delay here.
The
fact that there was another woman who kind of had Cleo's role, that there was somebody who could kind of step in. There was another housekeeper, or,
right? I think the other housekeeper was more the cook, and I think Cleo was the
sure, maid. But she was doing a lot of the day to day. That if something had happened, that if she had snapped or had otherwise done something that really set the mom off, then like there was somebody lined up waiting to take her job.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. I mean, it made me wonder about sort of exactly the class dynamics, in the sense of, I wasn't 100% sure how well off they were supposed to be. I mean, obviously they're well off. I mean, that they're not like poor or working class, but I couldn't tell. I mean, like, that both. So one of my best friends comes from India. You know, I was born in the States, but my family comes from Malaysia, and those are both countries where it's fairly normal to have servants. Not necessarily. Again, I mean, I don't want to diminish, you know, there's a degree of privilege from that, and a lot of the family on my mother's side is pretty wealthy, but that it's, I think the association that having a servant has in the United States, you're like, oh, like shit, like you must be rich. I think doesn't, it's more like, oh, like you're, you know, a well-off middle-class person. It's normal to have a family. I mean, not normal to have live-in help. But then it was interesting because as the movie goes on, there are these sort of these allusions to the mother, you know, having some financial difficulties because of the father leaving. But what you don't see is any of the staff being let go. Mm. They have three people on staff, the driver, the cook, and the maid, and all of them are still part of the staff. And I don't know if that was just, her, you know, because it just didn't occur to her that that would be an area that you would cut, or actually they were doing better off than we knew. Because, I mean, certainly she can still take these vacations. She does get rid of we should probably not get too much into the ending yet, but... yeah, it wasn't totally clear to me how rich they were meant to be.
Yeah, I think that was part of it as well, that, like, not just that, but there were pieces of it where, like, and I think it was said in one of the reviews I read that Cuarón, the director, is his movie, that it's the most personal thing he's ever done.
Yeah.
And, like, I think there's some advantage. Like, I don't know anything about Mexico in the 70s. I don't know a lot about Mexico's history generally, other than, like, way back 1942, the Yucatan, and, like, you know, or 1492, and, like, you know, what happened with Texas, because I grew up in Texas and took Texas state history. So, like, other than that, like, I don't – there was, like, a lot of stuff. There was some sort of student revolution going on. There was a lot that I just, like, I wish that I was just a touch more clued in to see all of the little pieces of it that I think were planted there for someone in the know. Do you know what I mean? Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That there's certain
and how wealthy they are is one of the questions.
Well, yeah, I'm...
you know, like, how... I didn't know how to evaluate their wealth. I thought, like, of course the staff would be the first to go, but I don't. But that's not how it worked out. So it was confusing to me as well.
I mean, I think that's less important. I think the gradient of, like, their particular wealth level, whether they're, like, upper middle class or actually rich, is less important than the setting in which it's placed. I mean, you know, like we get to travel around a lot, and I was in Lagos a couple of weeks ago, and you get off the plane, and then, like, all of a sudden there's just like giant sprawling, I don't know, the best thing I can think to call it is, like, shanty towns, as they call them in Jamaica, just, like, you know, basically like slums. And that was very much a part of the movie. I mean, she goes to seek her, I don't know what you would call him, boyfriend, or, you know,
Fermin, her boyfriend.
Yeah
her novio.
Insofar as I guess he was actually a boyfriend, that almost seems like too strong for, like, that horrible relationship they had. But she, you know, she gets off the bus and she, like, is in what we would consider, like, a very, like, bad area, like in a slum, you know, and, like, she has to, like, walk across a board to get across these, like, these super muddy waters. And I think that's more important. I think the juxtaposition between, like, where he's from and most likely where she's from as well versus this wealth that she's living in now because of this family is sort of more important than the gradient of whether or not they can afford to continue to keep the servants.
The only reason that the gradient of the family's wealth is important is because of the decision to keep Cleo on. Because at the end of the day, the mother was changing things about her life and her lifestyle to be able to deal with the situation at hand, the financial situation at hand. And she chose, Cleo's part of a family, Cleo's staying. And she said that to her whole, you know, family, Cleo. And knowing the weight of that decision, I think, is important. I think you can get the gist of it without that, but it would be interesting to know if she had chosen to get rid of Cleo, does she have to switch jobs still? Like, those things are, you know, that was a, like, kind of resonating question in my head.
Well, she did switch jobs, right? I mean, right. She says that she at has the end.
But would she have had to if she kept Cleo?
Right. Like, what were the other options? And I guess that, you know, there's certain decisions. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the most important thing, but I think that part of what makes the movie interesting is sort of tracking these kind of different gradations of class and how money and power can kind of like reinforce each other. So I think, yeah, I mean, if I need more,
right?
Yeah. One other thing I think has come up in some of the reviews. I mean, overall, this is generally considered probably the best Netflix original film that's ever been released. That it's probably going to be, you know. That they're doing a real campaign to try to get it nominated for a Best Picture Oscar.
Buster Scruggs was rated higher on that one list you sent me.
That's true. But I think in general, Roma is sort of seen as like the like kind of big contender this year for Netflix. I think one of the sort of dissenting voices is people pointing out that, Jordan, as you were saying, this is like a very personal movie for the director, Alfonso Cuarón, because he grew up in this neighborhood in Mexico. The house, I think, is supposed to be basically a replica of the house he grew up in, and that he did these interviews with the woman, you know, the maid who basically raised him and his siblings. And I think the question is, or one of the questions that I'm still not entirely decided on myself, is to what extent did he succeed in making her a full, vivid character with her own concerns and desires, and to what extent did he just kind of make her this saint? And like his idea that, of course, like because she raised him, that he has this completely idealized picture of her. But is that really the does she get to fully live as a character, or is she still in this sort of two-dimensional view that the child had of her?
Yeah, and I think that critique is really fair. I think it's like, especially when you take the context of the film, I'm trying to say this without revealing the plot. If it sounds roundabout, that's why. But like, whatever plot there is, like what Cleo goes through, her real true growth arc as a person and individual and character is put in the context of what I would imagine, like, maybe this is unfair and stereotypical of me, but like that is what a man's idea of her being a full bodied human being is going through this particular experience, right? As opposed to all of the other things that it means to be a woman and a person. And so I don't know, I think that's like a pretty fair critique, if you catch my drift with that.
Right. I mean, some of that, again, we can talk about it more in spoilers, but I agree that there's something about that. I mean, it made sense that I understood why that was sort of I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the pregnancy ends up being sort of dominating a lot of the second half of the film. And I think that's both believable, but then sort of reduces her to either maid or pregnant mother, and she doesn't really have an identity outside of that. And maybe that's realistic. Maybe that's in that, you know, specific economic context, she doesn't get to be anyone other than that. But it was, after having read those reviews, it was something I definitely wrestled with a little bit.
I mean, she was going out and trying to have a life.
She was going out and being with her boyfriend, and she had her friends who are also housekeepers of, you know, other families or within her own household. And, you know, it felt like she started out more dimensional than she ended. It's almost like her journey was from going from a blossoming human being to really being Cleo, the housekeeper, the one raising the kids, the one supporting the mother, and taking care of the house. Like, it almost became less so. You know what I mean? And especially, you know, it finishes on a shot of her going from the main house quarters to her quarters and the plane flying over. It's like nothing, you didn't go anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, that's kind of the point though, right?
Right. Okay, so let's say now, let's talk about the ending. We're going into spoilers. If you don't want to be spoiled for Roma, you should stop listening now. It's not
really
a really plot driven
film, movie,
but there are actually
honestly
a few things I was really in suspense about. So
I'm glad I didn't read about it. And Anthony, I was telling you there was a point where I was actually like yelling at my computer screen when she ventures into the water. Like, it was one of the most tense. I mean, obviously, like, he's very good at doing that. He did like Gravity.
So well shot.
Yeah.
So well shot. It never leaves her.
And as
Rife, see what she's looking at.
As rife with symbolism as he can possibly be, like, so that scene specifically is, she's, this is like after the, this is the vacation to the seaside that they go on, where so the mother can
let's
tell
go through the plot real quick so that people know where is the point this would be. So she's gotten pregnant from a boyfriend who has ditched her. The second he learns that that's the case, she goes and seeks him out again. He says, I'll beat you up if I see you again, so don't come to me with this baby shit. And then after she loses the baby is born dead, stillborn or whatever, then she's at the vacation with the mom. And then this happens. Go ahead, Ryan. Because okay. Like all of those things are important to what happens in the water.
Sure. So the mother tells them that they're going on vacation to just sort of, I think, get out and just like celebrate the fact that she's pregnant and all these things. And it turns out that it's really an opportunity for her to tell the kids that she's splitting up with the father. They go to the shore. Cleo can't swim. The kids are playing in the water. The mother, I don't remember what the mother goes off to do.
I think she's checking the car.
Okay.
Because they're leaving the next day. She's checking
the
car.
And it's going from low tide to high tide, too, which you can tell if you've ever been to the beach. Like, you could see that that was what was happening. But
I mean, you know.
That it was calm, and the mom called it calm, too.
You know from the minute the mom leaves, like, or the minute they say that she can't swim. Something like, you know exactly what's going on. So, but it's like, you know, again, one of the sort of more on the nose pieces of symbolism in the movie is this image of her. So the kids are playing in the water, and obviously, like as children do, they keep going deeper and deeper. One of the kids comes out. She, you know, puts him in a towel, and then has to run back out of the kids, and is slowly sort of walking through the water and being like sucked into the water. The kids are nowhere to be seen for a pretty extended period of time, and she's like going after them, and more getting in over her head.
It's interesting because I think...
Well, and they film it perpendicular to her. So, like, the whole scene is shot from, like, the wave line or whatever, right? And it follows her up further into the beach where she just takes the towel on and it follows her back down the beach. But you're always seeing her profile. And the whole time she's calling out to these kids and getting deeper and deeper in the water. But all you can see is her profile as she gets kind of crashed by these waves. And... it's intense, man.
Well, I think it's interesting to compare it also to Gravity, where, I mean, which is an amazingly made film in its own way. But in some ways, like, I watched that, and most of the time, I'm like, I knew that Sandra Bullock, this is a spoiler for Gravity, I suppose, that Sandra Bullock wasn't going to die. And yet this, right, which is much more low stakes in some ways, because it's just, you know, some people on a beach. But in a sense, this was more suspenseful than anything in Gravity, that I was just, like, leaning forward, and I was definitely half convinced, because, you know, it's close to the end of the movie. I'm like, wow, is he really going to just have her drown for these kids, or is one of the kids going to drown? Like, who knows? And it's like you were saying, it's shot in this way, not just that you sort of track her movements, but that, like, you don't follow her into the waves, and so you just see, like, little, like, kids, you kind of don't know exactly what's going on. You see little heads kind of bobbing above the waves, but you don't know... exactly, you know, the dynamics of what she's done to save that. You just know, like, oh, like something really bad is happening, but she's managed. And then eventually you're like, okay, they all made it out. Oh, thank God.
Well, and like, there was some weird level of like realism to it too. Like, I think drowning is often portrayed as this like very dramatic, splashing thing. In reality, like little kids in the ocean that get tired out by being hit in the face with waves just get tired. Like, they can't, you know what I mean? Like, it's as simple as that. And they just go under.
And they're dumb. And they're also dumb.
Yeah. They just,
like, swim out further than they should.
I mean, she said so many times, stay shallow, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it,
anyway,
obviously.
Yeah, it was really good.
Sorry, like, I saw it 2 days ago and I got my timeline mixed up. She's already lost the baby at that point, right?
She's lost the baby.
By the time they're in the water.
Well, and that goes to show too, like, the mom comes back and they're all up on the beach, like, they everything's already happened. The mom doesn't necessarily witness it, and the kids say, like, Cleo saved us. And they have, like, you know, actually I think it's the cover art for the movie itself is them on the beach in that moment, like, embracing each other, but
it looks like a sweet
Cleo
moment.
That moment,
that's the crazy thing, like, you watch the trailer, which is like, it's a really bad trailer because it's just like, it gives you nothing, no idea of, other than like that it's a pretty film, of what you're getting into. The box art is interesting because it does look like kind of a sweet moment of all of them embracing on there, but it's like coming at the end of this really tragic thing. But in terms of getting back to that idea of realism, I think one of them is obviously this idea of like, they're not in space, right? So they're in the ocean. They're like in we've all been through that. Anyone who's ever like was a kid and went to the beach probably felt that moment of like, oh no, like I'm, you know, a few seconds get it away from being pulled in. And also I think the thing that like really drove it home to me is yeah, she is this kind of sainted figure, but you know, in order for a character to really be beatified, like they end up dying tragically, right? I mean, that just seemed like, it almost seemed like that was like what had to happen to her in this movie, because you're watching this like really like a great character who's, you know, just basically like shit upon and like has all these really horrible things. The man is a total piece of garbage. The moment where she loses the baby is just like is heart-wrenching, and you're like, yeah, of course she's gonna die. Like of course he's gonna kill her.
And I mean, I think that I prefer it was funny because that moment where she saves the kid, she comes out, everyone's crying. And she confesses, like, I didn't want this baby to be born, which, I mean, I think then is really powerful because it speaks this sort of unspoken thing that you probably, that, like, as a viewer you had, which is, like, what's it going to be like when this kid is born and she's trying to maintain this job? That's going to be really tough. And so that she says that out loud, everyone cries and says that they love her, and it's this incredibly powerful scene. And I thought that was the end of the movie. But the movie keeps going, which I thought was, I really liked, because then it showed that, like, that again, I fully, especially the mother when she says it, and that's the first time she's said to Cleo that she loves her. The kids have said, I think, have expressed expression, but the affection, but like the mother has never really been so open with Cleo, except maybe to be like, men are garbage, we're women together, but not in that sort of naked kind of way.
She had to actually save her like two of her three children from certain death.
Yeah, and but I think that like,
and it goes.
That happens, and then I think there's a sense of yes, they love Cleo, she's part of the family. And then they get back, and then Cleo goes to work, because that's what, you know, that's...
In the same exact way she did at the beginning of the movie, right? It's like almost like a shot-for-shot remake of, like, her, like, pulling the thing off the railing and going room to room.
And so I thought that was really powerful. And I thought that was exactly the right way to end the movie.
It begs the question also of, like, the gradation of their relationship, because if you think about it really, yes, Cleo saved her kids, and Cleo did love those kids. But did Cleo really have a choice whether or not she was going to go into the ocean after those kids? Like, do you think that she really had a choice? Like, if those kids die drowning, even though she can't swim and the mom knows she can't swim, she's standing on the beach when the mom comes back and those kids are nowhere to be seen. Do you think Cleo still has her life with them? You know what I mean? Like, I don't, probably not, right? So it goes to question, again, like, I think there's a really beautiful dynamic throughout this whole movie of, is it the power structure or is it authentic love that powers these people's decisions?
Right, or that there's almost something of where, because the power structure creates these roles for you, but then they feel real and they become the roles that you have. And so that she's the sort of surrogate mother for these kids because she's been hired to do that, but then they build a real relationship and then they do feel that way towards each other.
Yeah, interesting. And I thought the ending was beautiful, too. Like I said, by the end of the movie, there was a scene about halfway through the film where there's, like, a fire in a field. And I was like, what the hell am I looking at? And after that, I was like, I think I'm going to start paying really close attention. And by the end, I was on the edge of the couch.
It did almost feel like, and maybe this is just because I did watch a trailer before I said it, it almost feel like it was just, like, collection of scenes that were somehow pieced together into a movie in some points. Like there was the thing I've thought about it a lot because I don't quite know how it fits in the movie, but when she goes back to the village and visits Fairman, and there's, you know, they're doing the whatever the martial art they were doing was at the time.
I don't know.
I can't remember specifically what it was.
Yeah, whatever the hell that thing was.
But okay, so that was part of his character. Like, that was a thing that he was obsessed with. That's why he felt like he couldn't, like, devote any of her life to her. And then, obviously, you got this, like, really bizarre scene where he's, like, playing with the shower curtain hanger as a bow staff. And it's just, like, his wang is just flopping all over the place. But I want to, you know, there's a funny moment in that with sort of the larger where they're doing the martial art where, you know, the master is pretty hilarious. He sort of like shows up in a silver LeMay suit. And then there is, I think, again, one of the more sort of on the nose moments when you talk about this idea of her being the saint is he demonstrates this thing that looks really simple where he sort of stands up, he holds his hands above his head, and he puts one of his legs sort of at a 45 degree angle. His foot at his knee.
His inside knee.
And is able to stand. And everyone's
and
like.
Closes his eyes. Thing.
And everyone says, oh, this looks really simple.
He's
and you watch this field full of people falling over. And the one person who is able to stand with no problem is Cleo.
Yeah. Yeah, that seemed a little
on
the nose. It was a little much, right?
I think the one other thing for me that was a little on the nose was there's a scene where they go shopping for the crib, and then there's this riot outside, which I thought was really well done in the sense that like it starts out being a protest, and they're like, oh, it's just traffic. We can go about our business as usual, and suddenly it just gets more and more violent, and suddenly the violence is in the store.
There's guys with guns.
Then the fact that her boyfriend is the one who runs in and is pointing the gun at them, I thought that seemed a little like... too on the nose.
It was just a movie moment.
Right. It felt a little bit too much.
In a way that the rest of it felt pretty realistic.
Right. And true to sort of the randomness of life. And that felt more scripted.
So one of my favorite scenes and one that I think had just almost as much kind of suspense and anticipation built into it as the wave crashing scene was the one where the family, everyone but the mother, the grandmother and the kids and Cleo are going out to the movies, I believe.
Yeah.
And the two oldest, or the oldest boy and his friend, I think. I don't think it's the brothers. It's the oldest boy and his
friend yeah.
run out ahead. And the grandmother's like, go, like, find them. And she's trying to be an adult and not run through the streets like two children. But she's also trying to catch up with them, and then she gets to an even busier intersection, and she's waiting at stoplights, and we still haven't found them, and I'm just like, oh my God, these kids, like, they could be taken, who knows, and she's trying to stay calm, but she doesn't actually look that anxious about it. It's almost like she knows exactly where they're going to be, and then she, you know, the dad ends up coming out of that building, like, that scene to me was just like, this is so intense. It's just them walking to the movies, but this whole situation is so intense, you know?
I had the same experience. It was so stressful.
I really
stressful.
Thought that was beautiful.
I mean, The whole movie I found like incredibly stressful. I mean, I think in a way that was largely intentional and part of what he was going for, right? It's amazing how much suspense he can wring out of these relatively small scenes.
Part of it, though, is, again, that I think that slow build. And I think the reason why, you know, it's like problematic to maybe put all of her identity in the pregnancy, but it, like that was certainly one of the sort of more obvious ways to keep the plot, to introduce a plot point into the movie and to give you a lot of this tension.
Yeah. I mean, the pregnancy I thought was handled well overall.
Yeah.
And certainly there's that sort of extraordinary sequence where they're trying to get to the hospital and they're stuck in traffic. And then even at the hospital, things are really crowded.
Which is like you actually skipped a very important part of the boyfriend coming in to the store where they're staying there. They're buying a crib.
That's when
her water breaks.
Yeah. And then there's that scene where and really it's the last time we see the father. He comes in and comforts her. And he's being really tender, even though you kind of know he's been a shit. And then he's like, I can't come with you, but I don't want you to know you're going to be okay. And the doctor's like, no, you can come. And he's like,
the father's a doctor, right?
Yeah, he's a doctor. Yeah. So that's why he's there. And I mean, I think that's, again, speaking to some of the privilege that she has is because she's part of this family that has a doctor in the family. I think that's like allowed her to sort of navigate this health system better. So it's interesting again, that there's a power dynamic there, but certainly it has also given her privileges. They also, like when she talks about her mother back at the village, and it's kind of like, I can't do anything for her.
I mean, exactly right. But she has this privilege that gets her up to the hospital. But at the end of the day, she still loses the child.
She loses the child, and she's there alone. And so they're like, do you have family here? And like, no.
Yeah.
And so it's
no one from the family was there.
Yeah.
And also like just the idea, the scene where they're arriving at the hospital, and you look at the front, like it's not even inside the hospital. It's like the front patio of the hospital has like 12 women in labor, just in labor, standing out there having their, you know, whatever, labor, like, in pain, right? Like, I mean, it was just nuts to me. I was like, oh, my God, get these women beds. Like, it was just stressing me out. And, I, you know, she arrives and gets bumped kind of to the front. But just the waiting room and the kind of madness of the hospital, but also the things that felt really procedural and precise as well. It was interesting, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, one other thing about the pregnancy that I wanted to bring up was just also that if you look at Alfonso Cuarón's last three movies, Children of Men, Gravity, and now Roma, is that in all of them, the protagonist has to deal with a dead child. I mean, in Children of Men, that's sort of the backstory. In Gravity, that's the backstory. In Roma, that happens in the course of the movie.
Well, Children of Men, I haven't seen Gravity, but Children of Men, like, that's the whole premise, is that they can't have children.
They can't have children, but also that, yeah. I think, I'm pretty sure this is the case, is that that the two main characters, Julianne Moore and Clive Owen, are estranged because they had a child who died.
That's such a simple, like, backstory. Like, that's so many movies have that plot
and I just,
point
yeah, and
as,
I
like,
feel
a
it,
piece
it,
of character development.
Right, and I think it, to me, and again, I don't know his own background in terms of, like, if this is a trauma that he's dealt with or something, but it feels to me like a little, like a especially in the other two movies, I think a very sort of just convenient kind of piece of backstory to give weight to the characters. And so I'm kind of hoping that we don't have that in his next film.
But it worked really well here because these children were such an important part of her life. And, like, she very clear, like, there's a touching moment toward the beginning of the film where she's waking them up and it's just like kissing them awake. And it's like, it's a very, like, tender relationship and one, like, you wouldn't see, certainly in this country, with most housekeepers. So there is a sense that you get that, like, yeah, like, she loves these kids. She would probably love to start a family. This is her opportunity to do it. Obviously, that rug is pulled out from under her almost immediately when this guy, like, she tells him in the movie theater that she's pregnant, and he says he's going to go get some ice cream or something, and then just, like, disappears. So it's obviously, like, something that it seems that she would like to have, but then, it, you know, Anthony, as you said earlier, there's that moment where it's like, you know, it seems like this tragedy, and of course it is this tragedy, and, like, it's really part of the reason why it's so heart-wrenching is you actually, like, watch her cradle the dead child in her hands, and then, you know, she has this other traumatic moment, and it all comes out that, like, she absolutely wasn't ready for it. So, I mean, I do think, like, on a fundamental level, it does make sense that that is an important part of her journey.
Right. It works in this film. I was a little bit resistant to it just because of, I felt like it was a trope that had been used in some of his other films. But certainly, I think in of all those examples, like, this is the one where it's done really well and done in a way that you know, does it justice.
It is interesting to watch in a lot of these movies. It was the same case with Shape of Water, where like, movies play a really important role. We're just, like, going to see movies. You know, you actually see, like, quite a bit of the films. You see there are two moments where they're in theaters. There's this first one where she's watching an old black and white movie, and, like, there's a bunch of people sitting. I mean, I guess everything in this movie would be black and white, to be fair. But she's watching, I think, like, it looks like a comedy of a bunch of people sitting in a plane. And then there's a moment which is almost like an homage to his last movie, where you sort of see this, like, these, like, astronauts, like, floating adrift. But I think that is quite a tell for a lot of these people, in the same way that writers write about writing or filmmakers make movies about Hollywood, that, like, people, you know, in his case, or, like, Guillermo del Toro, somebody growing up, or, like, Fellini, like, that going to see movies were such a sort of important part of their life, and they insert that very much into these films.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because it's, like, the counterexample is some people bring up that, like, in Star Wars, right, you never see anyone reading or watching it. Like, and that, as far as you can tell, everyone in Star Wars is functionally illiterate.
Yeah, there was, what was that book, Luke Skywalker Can't Read?
Yeah, it was my friend Ryan Britt wrote that, yeah. I agree that, like, it seems like it can, I think sometimes with Del Toro, that can get a little kind of cutesy.
Yeah.
This I thought was fine because it was just like,
they literally lived above the theater.
Right, and it's above, but in this case, it's more like, I'm sure that Cuarón's childhood was spent to a large extent in movie theaters, and so this is to an extent about his childhood, so of course movie theaters are going to play a big role in it. So I know we've been talking about this movie for a while. Maybe one thing to end on is just, so a lot of people either say best movie of the year, possibly best picture winner. Do you guys think this is the best movie of the year? Even though that's a completely arbitrary designation, and what does best even mean? But What do you think?
I don't think so.
No. Do you have a pick for best movie of the year?
I think it was... No. But, well, actually, did Disobedience come out this year? Rachel McAdams and Rachel...
Oh,
Rachel and Rachel?
I don't know.
Yeah. I saw it. I mean, I'm going to swing towards it because it's a movie about lesbians, but it was a really good movie about lesbians. I don't watch any of those highbrow movies until after the Academy announces it. I guess my point with why it's not the best one, although technically it's stunning and some of those shots just still kind of ring in your head, but Cleo just wasn't, you know, I don't know, just wasn't, didn't feel like a very fully formed character. And it felt like the only way to get the movie is if you're in on it. You know, like there were so many different questions. Like when she goes in for her first pregnancy appointment, you know, like what is the status of abortion in 1970s Mexico? Is that just completely out of the question? Like, why don't we know? Like, I just needed to know all of these things, and it was just left unsaid.
It's a Catholic country, so I assume it's pretty much off the table at that point.
And I guess I thought it was clear in the sense that no one ever brings up abortion as a possibility, which read to me as like, okay, like she can't have an abortion. But I agree, though, that there's things where
right,
you just sort of like
I get that, but
want some context.
Yeah, but it just feels like, yeah, I just felt like missing. And I get that maybe that was the intent, to like not need the context altogether, not need everything, just get what's put forth. But what is put forth is pretty vague, honestly. Cleo might have less lines than anybody else in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was just... I mean, some of the best movies I've seen are just very quiet, meditative. I can't remember the name of the director, but she did like Wendy and Lucy.
I'm not saying it's bad. I just don't know if it deserves best picture. That's all I'm saying.
I
think it should be in the running, though. I think it should be considered. It was really stunning and interesting, but I don't know if I would make it the best.
I think from a technical perspective, absolutely. It was just such an incredibly beautiful, well-shot movie. And I mean, we were going down a lot of the best picture nominee lists, and I couldn't, granted, I've been kind of behind on my movie watching this year, because I've been traveling so much, but, I can't think of one that I thought was just like front to back a better film.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are probably movies this year that affected me more. I mean, and some of those are specific to my interests, like Hereditary and Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, which I think are probably, I'm going to remember more than Roma.
But like, if you get a Venn diagram of those three things, Anthony is right in the middle.
Anthony Ha is in the center. But I think it is certainly one of the best movies of the year. And I mean, I think there are some things that sort of also just hold it back a little bit in my estimation. Some of the sort of the more movie-ish writing that we were talking about. I think I also just need to think about it some more, but I would be happy, you know, very happy and thrilled to see it nominated for Best Picture and even to see it win.
Best foreign film, certainly.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably going to win that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you guys once again for joining me to talk about Netflix. For listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, you can leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts. The board is telling you to leave a positive review. Jordan and Brian, thank you again, and happy holidays.
Thank you.